Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we have one of our periodic reporters' roundtables in which we get together with a few North Central Wisconsin journalists to talk about the top local stories and issues of the moment. And today, we are taking a somewhat wider focus as we look back on the big stories of 2007, and we look ahead at how those stories and new developments will impact the news in the upcoming year. Joining us this afternoon in our Wisconsin Public Radio studio, Pete Wasson, the opinion page editor of the Wausau Daily Herald, and Michael Lauber, reporter and weekend anchor for WSAW-TV News Channel 7. And rounding out our panel by telephone, Richard Moore, investigative reporter from the Lakeland Times in Minocqua. Again, a reporter's roundtable today on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. And Pete and Michael, thank you for being with us in the studio. And hello, Richard, up in Minocqua.
Hello.
One of the biggest stories of the past year, and I think if you ask most people that you'd run into on the street, what was the biggest story, it would have to be the shooting, the rampage up in Crandon that left seven people dead and then eight, including the gunman. I will say the misfortune, because this is one of the kinds of stories that you never want to cover. I had the misfortune of being in Crandon that day with my microphone, and this is a bit of what we heard in Crandon on that terrible day in October. Dan DeHart looked down the street toward the crime scene in his hometown of Crandon and said he couldn't believe it.
My son grew up with all of them, and I knew every one of them. You never think it's going to happen in a small town. And it's just a tragedy. Very bad.
Six young people had lost their lives by Sunday evening in this close-knit community, and a seventh was hospitalized in critical condition. The shooting involved a 20-year-old Forest County Sheriff's deputy who gunned down his ex-girlfriend and the others at her home. Local businessman Mike Kegley knew the killer.
Yeah, he was my son's friend. You know, he'd come over and, you know, we talked, well, Friday night he was here, we talked guns and just like a normal conversation, you know.
Is this in character for him? How can you explain that?
You would never expect it out of the kid. It's unbelievable.
More than 100 people gathered at Crandon's Praise Chapel Church during the day, waiting to find out who had been shot and trying to make sense of it all. Lay leader Bud Evans comforted the friends and relatives.
If you've never prayed ever in your life, pray tonight for these families. Pray for the officers, the families. Every death is a tragic loss to this community, and we just need the strength, I guess, and the prayers is the only way we're going to get it.
Now, the gentleman, Mike Kegley, who was on that clip, was the man who was with the killer just a few hours before the tragic end to an already tragic incident. He was holed up in his house in a rural part of the county just north of Crandon, and he spent the last few hours with him and told us that Tyler Peterson lost it after some people at the party he was with, where he was trying to reconcile with his girlfriend, called him a pig, made insulting remarks. Of course, that was denied by the survivor of that incident. But the whole thing brought into question police training, screening, and whether or not somebody who's only 19 years old should be put in that position on the street. Richard Moore, your reaction to the situation in Crandon.
Well, I think, as usual, it certainly is the top headline, if you will, the top story, a very tragic event. But as usually the case in these stories, you have deeper storylines running beneath the headline. We still have a lot of questions in Crandon about what happened and why and how. But certainly, in the weeks following, and I think the media did a pretty good job of this at first at least, we began to ask questions about how do we recruit, how do we train, how do we screen in Wisconsin, and we found that in some areas we were inadequate. I'm afraid that we're beginning to fade away from that in the press. I don't see much momentum to really taking a long-term inspection going on. Beyond that, I would say that the story gives us an opportunity, at least in the rural northern communities of northern Wisconsin, to look at how we oversee police agencies altogether. quite frankly, we don't have any reliable, adequate oversight of police agencies. Here in Minocqua, the town board oversees them. Virtually no town board is capable of doing that. And civil service and police commissions who have citizens members aren't much better at that. Now, we need those citizens and local citizens overseeing our police departments, but they need state support, state mechanisms, state systems. We don't have that right now. We need to take a look at it. And because we don't, in a lot of our northern Wisconsin communities, we have a lot of police misconduct and a lot of excessive use of force.
Pete, your reaction.
I don't deny that this is that there's a whole lot of police and oversight issues raised by this incident. But I think I look at it through a little bit different perspective. To me, this is first and foremost a domestic violence incident. And that's something that I think we're going to return to a little bit later in this conversation, because we have had several similar violent incidents in Wausau, in the Wausau
right.
area this year. And so I'm not saying that we shouldn't be looking at some of these police issues that Richard is raising, but I'd rather look at it as a domestic violence incident.
Michael, you had to go up to Crandon for the TV station to cover a football game, and your general impressions of the community and how they had to cope and try to conduct business as usual at an athletic event where many of the students knew many of the victims.
Right. Well, the phrase I heard over and over again that weekend was, they were trying to return to normalcy. That was really their effort, and they went behind the decision to hold the game as usual. But at that point, you could tell, I believe at the time the game was going on, there was also visitation for one of those who was killed going on at the same time. So a lot of the students weren't at the game, and those that were, just looking through the crowd, panning the crowd that evening, just the blank stares on their faces and the tears in their eyes. It wasn't anywhere close to a return to normalcy, and understandably at that point.
You know, that Sunday afternoon, it was so strange going up there, and it was almost like a festival atmosphere, and it's always like that when there's a tragic event like this. There are people in the streets everywhere, some of them talking, a warm summer day, kids on bicycles, kids on skateboards, and all of these satellite trucks lined up, mm-hmm. Lining the streets of this very small community, and it's only when you'd get up close to people that you'd see that they were shell-shocked. And there's no really, I think, a good answer to that. There are never good answers to stories like that. And all too frequently, there are no good answers to, as Pete said, the problems of domestic violence. And we are going to look at a series of violent incidents involving the Hmong community in Wausau and Weston, where people are actually trying to come up with some solutions, a task force to deal with what is really an enduring problem. The voices you're about to hear were recorded live on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're going to hear Peter Yang of the Hmong Mutual Association, domestic violence counselor Kashua Va, Weston Village Administrator Dean Zuliger, Everest Metro Police Chief Dan Vergine, and Jane Graham Jennings of the Women's Community.
The best way I can describe it is overwhelming sadness, in that part of the mission of the work that we do is to ensure that every family in our community is safe from such violence. And you kind of wonder, was there something else that we could have done? Was there some other way we could have reached out? Was there something that we didn't do that could have prevented this?
I've spoken to a number of young urban Asian males who are really urging their clan leaders, the elders, to be very, very forceful in requiring change in some of the attitudes of some of the Hmong clans. And these guys are saying enough is enough.
We need, you know, the families that have been involved in this this recent homicide to not to try to deflect the issue, not to try to make it go away, but to take the positive parts of family and commitment of the Hmong culture and now add this component that there won't be violence against women.
Just like domestic violence can't end, women can't solve or end domestic violence, we need men. Along with Hmong leadership, I think that there needs to be more women in leadership positions in clan. And it's different. It's going to be different from what we've known for hundreds of years, but it can be done.
I think in the U.S., we are seeing a significant number of women making the step to become leaders, and many of them are becoming leaders, and so it's great mm-hmm. to see that happening.
That's a hopeful note from Peter Yang of the Hmong Mutual Association. Now, Kashua Va, who we just heard from, is a domestic violence counselor, a Hmong woman, and she's from Madison. The reason we didn't have any local Hmong women who are domestic violence counselors, they were all afraid of retribution from the Hmong community and perhaps even threats that would come their way if they were to participate in the program. Pete, your general impression of all of this stuff that went on this past year.
I admire some of the things that the Western leadership is doing. But I think there's two separate layers to this story. There is very definitely a Hmong component here that we need to talk about. There's also a danger, I think, in saying it's only them. Because as we're sitting here this evening talking about this, there are people in our community being beaten and abused by their people who presumably love them. And as long as we look at this as just them doing this, we're not going to get to the heart of that issue, which we as a society, I think, have been avoiding for a long, long time.
Now, we've both been police reporters before, mm-hmm. having to go through those files every morning, and you do see that domestic violence is something that strikes all races, all nationalities, all creeds.
Income levels. And as Jane said in that clip, it's just terribly, terribly sad to read about that happening in our community every day.
And up in the North Woods, Richard, are there any unique components to the problem of domestic violence, or is it something that's really just endemic to our culture and it happens everywhere?
Well, I agree with Pete, and I think it is something endemic to the culture. I can't speak to the Hmong situation, but certainly it doesn't go on just there. There's domestic violence and domestic abuse in the North Woods. One of the things that concerned me was the recent release of Department of Justice statistics on domestic abuse reports and arrests in the state of Wisconsin. And one of the things that jumped out of me was that in Oneida County, where we are, and in the surrounding counties, we have a far lower arrest rate for domestic abuse reports than elsewhere in the state. And I think until the criminal justice system gets serious about this, we have domestic abuse counselors, we have domestic abuse organizations, and they do a powerful and great job. But I think there perhaps is a double standard in the criminal justice system that needs to be taken a look at. Those statistics are glaring to me, and that's really a serious problem. It also speaks to me to be a very much cultural problem as well. I think it does occur at all income levels, but certainly poor households seem to have these kinds of problems at a greater rate anyway than others.
They're under a lot of stress, and maybe rich people can cover them up a little bit better.
And cover up as well, absolutely.
You're listening to Route 51, regional talk radio for North Central Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Moberg. We've got a reporter's roundtable. We'll be back after this.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Wausau's Woods and Art Museum, where 50 historic paintings reflect America's love affair with water, and 40 photographs celebrate boating on Lake Geneva now through January 20th. Online preview at lywam.org.
For more information on regional programming for North Central Wisconsin, here at Wisconsin Public Radio, or to have your community event listed with us, check out our local website at wpr.org/WLBL. We're doing a reporter's roundtable today on Route 51. I'm Glenn Moberg. Our guests, Pete Wasson of the Wausau Daily Herald, also Richard Moore of the Lakeland Times, and Michael Lauber of News Channel 7. And one of the big local issues, and I want to delve into this a little bit more because it involved open records and freedom of information. This involved the 3-year-old McCleary Bridge, which had to be struck down because of structural problems, dramatic evidence uncovered in an investigation that was conducted by Pete's newspaper. A 3-week investigation by the Wausau Daily Herald uncovered a videotape in 7 boxes of materials related to the McCleary Bridge construction and subsequent inspections.
We're on the west side of the pier.
On the tape, Brian Schroeder, a diver from Ayers Associates Structural Engineers in Eau Claire, picks up a common claw hammer and taps on one of the bridge's submerged concrete footings. And as he taps, chunks of brittle concrete fly off the structure in a cloud of chalky dust.
And again, that concrete is very loose, chalky. It breaks up real easily.
The reporters who uncovered the tape, Janet Craig-Miles and Rick LaFromboy, were stunned by the image.
He was able to go and just by tapping on part of this footing, large chunks were just breaking away and debris was floating in the water.
Anytime you see chunks of concrete falling away from a support on a bridge that you had crossed multiple times a week, and sometimes more than once daily, anybody who sees this, I would think, would probably have some raised eyebrows afterwards.
Michael, how did you feel driving over that bridge after you saw and read about and heard that report?
Boy, we did a lot of joking in the newsroom about whether we would feel safe driving back and forth over it. I guess even now, maybe it's even a little bit more scary than it has been, because you look over the side and you see a couple of the lanes there are half gone. They're working
down
on it.
Down to one lane in each direction. Pete, tell us a little bit about that investigation and how. To me, this just shows you how important newspapers are, because without newspapers, we wouldn't have had that story.
Well, I think it tells you how important Wisconsin's open records law is, because our reporter and editor went through, as you said, seven boxes of documents. Certainly, I think that the parties involved would have preferred us not to be looking through those documents. But when they came back with that DVD and popped it into the computer and showed it to the rest of us in the newsroom, we all looked at it and went, holy cats, I can't believe that's going on. Our readers have to know about this.
Those reporters must have looked like, kids in a candy store.
Well, I think they were as shocked as anyone else. And I think we still don't know all the answers that we want in this story. We've had engineers look at some of those documents. We still don't know who ultimately signed off on the way in which that concrete was poured. And I'm sure there's more documents that we can get our hands on, try and find out more.
Richard, I know open records requests, freedom of information investigations, that's all part and parcel of your work up at the Lakeland Times, which really, for a small newspaper, you have a very solid journalistic tradition.
Open records, thank you for that remark, but open records are probably the top thing we're concerned with. And I think our attitude is that open records make it possible to do investigative journalism. Without open records, you can't have open, honest, democratic government. But I think people need to know, and I think the press needs to do a better job of reporting, that our open records laws are really under attack. They're under attack in the legislature. They're under attack by the courts. They're under attack by state agencies. And we really need to do a lot better job of promoting the importance of open records. I think part of the problem are the larger, with notable exceptions, larger corporate media. If you don't do investigative journalism, and there's a lot less of it today than there used to be, if you don't do it, then there's really no reason to spend a lot of effort promoting or maintaining or strengthening the open records laws.
You're involved with some litigation right now that really speaks to this issue.
We are. We won a major case in the appellate court last year against the DNR for the disciplinary records of a then DNR warden who had been accused of breaking the Driver's Privacy Protection Act. We've been recently in litigation also involving the DNR, where we had asked for the title positions, the salaries, and the names of certain DNR employees in certain offices. We were given the title positions and the salaries, but not the names.
But these are public employees, aren't they? I mean, we're paying for those salaries.
We're paying for those salaries, and the reason they gave us was, well, when they did the union negotiations and the contract was signed, the contract, they negotiated an exemption from the open records law on those names so that they could keep them confidential. Now, we went to Dane County Circuit Court, and we won in Dane County Circuit Court. Our argument is that this is the public's right to know, public information, and that it is absurd to think that you can negotiate an exemption to state law. And Dane County Circuit Court, we won. That court is on appeal. And then in the current case, which will be heard later this month, we're in litigation with Lakeland Union High School over their denial of disciplinary records for the last 5 years for their faculty and staff. Now, as we showed in the Cropeland case and that Warden case, we think it's vital to have access to disciplinary records for public employees. We are the taxpayers, we are the employers, and when you engage in misconduct, it's vital for public safety to understand what that misconduct was, and there's a second component to it. It's also vital to know how the governmental unit handled that misconduct, what discipline they imposed, because if it's a slap on the wrist, If it's not appropriate for serious misconduct, then we feel you're encouraging more misconduct.
And Pete Wasson, the Wausau Daily Herald, was involved with very similar issues in Cronenwetter.
Yeah, we won a case last year when a judge ruled that the village had improperly withheld some personnel records held by government officials. And, you know, I really feel for a lot of government officials who, particularly in small towns and villages, who are elected or appointed to roles without fully understanding the complexities of open records and open meetings law in Wisconsin. And it's very explicit. The Attorney General's office will send municipal officials a guide and even hold training for them. But it's still very complex.
Do you feel that open records, the openness of government, is this under attack right now? And I think maybe a lot of it is because since September 11th, we have this whole expectation that governmental bodies are going to be conducting their operations in greater secrecy than they have before.
I think that we've come to accept a frightening degree of government intrusion into our lives. And so I guess I would look at it and say that in some ways our privacy as people is under attack as well. But that's separate from the issue of public records. What I think happens is that some, particularly in small towns, elected and appointed officials get this attitude that the records are theirs and that that they will release them as they see fit. They lose sight of the fact that they are our records, that it's our tax money that's going to pay for the people who compile them and keep them, and it's our information that we know that we need to know to interact with our government efficiently.
Just to conduct our basic civic responsibilities as voters, we need to know what the government is doing.
And what's really tragic is that every time newspapers don't want to get into court fights over these things because
and television and radio stations don't either.
I'm sure
because a lot of times you're hurting some of your advertisers who are connected with some of these public officials.
Well. There's a larger issue, too, I think. Not only, I mean, when we won this case with Cronenwetter, we won damages and attorney's fees. That has to come out of somebody's pocket. And not only does that come out of taxpayers' pockets or the village's insurance companies, but I think it just gradually serves to erode the public's confidence in their government and, by extension, in the media.
Richard, we've only got about 15 seconds here. Your final thoughts on this subject before we break for news.
Well, I think Pete is right on some of the small towns thinking that the records are theirs, but I would also point out that we've had a major court battle over a small town issue like that, the GPS case a few years ago, where they ruled that virtually any document that a government attorney sees is subject to attorney-client privilege. That's a serious blow to the open records law. It started in a small town. It ended in the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
We're doing a Route 51 Reporters Roundtable. We'll be back right after this. We are back on Route 51, Regional Talk Radio for North Central Wisconsin, with our Reporters Roundtable. I'm Glenn Moberg, and our guests today, Pete Wasson, the opinion page editor of the Wausau Daily Herald, Michael Lauber, the anchor reporter for WSAW-TV, News Channel 7, and joining us by telephone, Richard Moore, investigative reporter for the Lakeland Times in Minocqua. And today we are looking back at the top news stories of the past year and the stories that are going to be significant for the upcoming year. And that, of course, brings us to the economy. The stock market dropped another 300 points today. The economy has certainly replaced the Iraq War as the biggest concern facing voters and the presidential candidates. But our longtime Congressman Dave Obey thinks the issues are tied together. Here are some of his recent comments, again on a day when the market dropped another 300 points.
This is what happens when you run a war without paying for it. We're going to spend this year over $170 billion on the war in Iraq and not pay for a dime of it, borrow the money from China. And I think people are aware that with the subprime lending crisis and the drop in housing values, that we could also run into volatility in the energy area. One day people are talking about $40 oil. The next day they're talking about $100 oil.
China holds $1.3 trillion of foreign reserves. They threaten to liquidate them if we impose trade sanctions.
That's correct. They're in a position to extract blackmail because we've allowed ourselves to get in this position.
Did you ever think, growing up in the 50s in Wausau, that we would be in debt to a communist country 50 years later?
No, I didn't. It blows my mind, and I never dreamed that you would have a Republican administration borrow as much money as this administration decided to borrow.
Dave Obey, as always, being quite partisan. Richard Moore, your reaction to his comments on the economy.
Well, I'd like to take a look from the Northwoods perspective at the economy. I think we have to do a lot up here in focusing on the issue of poverty. And that's one thing, that's economic development. And certainly we need economic development and light industry and jobs here, but it's a whole lot more. It's child care and it's health care. And it's all bundled together to come up with the solutions to the poverty question. And I think as journalists, we need to take a look. We're some of the poorest counties up here in the Northwoods outside of Milwaukee County. We are the poorest counties, where we have 25-30% of children on school lunch programs, free breakfast programs. And as journalists, what I want us to do is to take a look at these issues and take a look from the perspective that what these people want to do is really have a decent life. You know, they want to have a good home for their families. They want to be able to get up in the morning and go to work, to a good job, and take their children to good child care and to good schools. And then they want to come home and they want to have a meal for their family, but not just a good nutritious meal. They want to be able to give their families the little treats in life that make life worth living. And if we forget to look at that as journalists, then we're not worthy of the title. And we need to examine these issues. We've got people up here working two and four jobs. And part of the problem of poverty is that in the old days, the culture, the media didn't see poverty, but a lot of times these people don't see that they're poor because they do work one, two, three jobs, and they manage to scrape together a living, but then all of a sudden they are poor because all of a sudden the jobs are gone.
Richard, let me ask you this. Your economy up there is so dependent upon the tourism industry. I spend a lot of time camping and fishing up there, and towing my boat up there for a week or a weekend now can cost me a couple hundred dollars in gasoline. How prepared is your area on for $3.25 per gallon gasoline that seems to be here to stay?
Maybe $4 a gallon.
Maybe $4. I don't think we're prepared at all, and I don't think we're prepared for anything else that might affect the tourist economy. In fact, we see one of the things we need to take a look at here is the economic landscape in the Lakeland area. We're a tourist town, always have been. When I came here 13 years ago, the big question was, everybody was scared we were going to be Wisconsin Dells. That's no longer on the table. The question is, now are we going to be Lake Geneva? A lot of the little amusement parks, a lot of little motels are going by the wayside. Condos are going up, and we have an oversaturated market. So not only do we not have industry and jobs, we could be facing a tourist collapse for many reasons, and no, I don't think we're prepared for it.
Michael, how many stories get assigned every day at News Channel 7 that have economic impact to them? I imagine that's getting to the point where that's the majority of the assignments that your great assignment editor, Dennis Dalsky, gives on a daily basis.
But yeah, it seems to be the case. There's always something, of course, that people like to talk about, gas prices. That's something that has a immediate and obvious impact on everyone, and you can clearly see it posted there out by the roads. The housing market as well. From talking to local real estate people that I did, it sounds fortunately like maybe locally that's not having quite as much of an impact as in much of the nation, but something that no doubt will.
And this downturn appears to just be starting. Mm-hmm. And if they can't juice the economy in an election year, I think we might be in a little bit of trouble.
You know, we talked earlier about the tragedy and sadness involved in some of these domestic violence incidents. Think of the tragedy and sadness involved in the families in Wisconsin Rapids who have given their lives to a company and in return gotten a good wage that they've come to count on, and those jobs have disappeared now. I can't imagine what the families over there are going through.
You know, we have that problem in Rhinelander too, where that was sort of our industrial town, and we've seen most of those big industries shut down over the last 5 or 6 years, and it's the same problem.
The Domtar paper mill was 25% of the tax revenue for Port Edwards. So that's going to hit everybody twice. They're not only losing their jobs, but their taxes are going to go up. It's going to cost more for their utilities.
Well, it's going to hit them three times, because it ripples out from there to all the other trades and services that are in some way connected with the paper industry. We're going to feel it over here, I think.
And just last week as well, I was in Wisconsin Rapids talking to the Catholic schools there, who now they're reorganizing, and this is something they had been talking about before that mill closed in particular, but they said the fact that they're restructuring now definitely prepares them to handle such a blow like that. So you can see its effect even on the schools.
You just had to close two Catholic schools in the Wisconsin Rapids
right.
area. And, of course, healthcare is always a huge problem, which has great economic impact. The cost of healthcare keeps going up. More and more employers can't afford the coverage for their employees. And it was all tied up in the debate over the state budget this past year with the Healthy Wisconsin proposal, which tied up the state legislature. Here's Abbotsford Assembly Republican Scott Suter and Senate Democrat Russ Decker of Weston, now the Senate Majority Leader, at a Chamber of Commerce forum this past fall.
I'll tell you one thing it's done. Healthy Wisconsin has changed the debate in this state about something that has some traction, of something that has support from the private and public sector, and something that really takes on and reforms health care in the state of Wisconsin. There are a lot of people that want the status quo when it comes to health care because they're making big bucks off of it. And I think for us to reform the system, we've got to take a step forward and have some courage.
Government-run health care. This is a 16 or 17-member board that's going to be appointed by the governor that's going to be deciding what your health care looks like. All you have to be is a resident. You have to live in the state of Wisconsin. I think that will create serious costs for the program because I think you'll have an influx and people will flock to this state from other states and perhaps other countries for free health care. I don't think that's right.
Pete Wasson, your general perspective on the debate over health care and over the state budget and the impasse that seemed to drag on for months and months this past summer.
These people, I don't know what to say about them. I admire Decker for proposing Healthy Wisconsin and starting this conversation. But listening to those two right there, I couldn't tell if they, at some point, I think some of these guys have stopped fighting for what they believe in and started fighting to be fighting. And I think with the narrow majorities in the Senate and the Assembly, this year we're just going to see more and more of this. And it's we talked a little bit earlier, I mentioned the erosion in confidence in government. I don't know that it can get a whole lot more eroded than it already is, but they sure seem to be working on it.
Richard, your perspective.
Well, the health care issue, those are also very important in northern Wisconsin. I agree. I think the debate was largely partisan and political. I do think it was noble to put Healthy Wisconsin on the table. I also think there were flaws in that and significant flaws with the impacts that were never taken care of, or how they would take care of the impacts on small business, which would affect us in the north. I'm not sure universal health care, which is a great idea, but I'm not sure it's a state solution. But I do know that there are good organizations and people working in the Northwoods to tackle individual issues like access to dental care. And we have only like one child psychiatrist in all of the Northwoods north of Wausau. Those are problems we need to be tackling, and we need to be, and I think people are here, but the Healthy Wisconsin was just, the debate over Healthy Wisconsin was just one more example of gridlock and the erosion of a true democratic process in Madison.
And I would agree, Richard, that it's by no means a perfect solution, but the alternative is the status quo, and I think just about everybody can agree that the status quo ain't working.
You better believe that.
Michael, your attitude toward the budget impasse and toward the gridlock that seems to characterize our political process.
Boy, I guess when I think about the budget impasse, for me, I think about schools and the local governments. I just going to UW-Marathon County a few times and hearing frustration from the administration just on not knowing what to expect, and from students on not knowing if they'd be receiving grant money and that sort of thing. And the impact that had on, probably impact on enrollment directly, with students not knowing what they'd be able to afford. And local governments as well, feeling like they had worked hard and had the budgets as their local budgets as ready to go as they could, but we're dealing with those frustrations of not knowing the exact numbers because of the state.
Those UW schools produced a great leader, Lee Sherman Dreyfus, the maverick Republican governor, former UW Stevens Point chancellor, who succeeded at an improbable campaign for governor. Now, I want you to listen to this. Here in his own words, this was recorded when he was governor, his comments on two issues that still bedevil politics today: politicians afraid to change their positions and the power of special interest groups.
And that's all they've got, is that one issue. You can be an absolute crook on everything else, but if you're on the right side of the right issue, we're with you, and if you're on the wrong side, we're against you. Well, one, I now question that those special interest group leadership are real. I really wonder if they can deliver the votes they say they have. In fact, my own feeling is they cannot. Obviously, they can deliver the dollars. My own proposal is to put a giant limit on that. I don't understand this. Anybody say, 6 months ago you said exactly this, you've changed. As if there's something wrong with change. I come from an academic field where we look at change as absolutely necessary. In fact, I'll reverse 180 degrees. Somebody give me information that says it ought to be changed. Let us not put our political leadership into a box, and the political process communicatively tends to do that. You made a change from this to this.
You get the feeling that if Lee Sherman Dreyfus was running for president, he'd say, you're damn right I flip-flopped, and I'm proud of it.
Isn't that exactly the problem? Out here in the real world, learning and informing yourself and having your opinion evolve over time is something that we tend to admire in a person, but in politics you're branded a flip-flopper.
Richard, we need more Lee Sherman Dreyfuses in politics.
We certainly do, and the success of his improbable campaign shows us why we still have elections, regardless of what the polls say. But in remarks on the special interest, I'd like to point out that we have shifted fundamentally over the last 20 years in this country. Bill Clinton, when he was first president, convened a cabinet meeting, and he had a great remark. And he said, and they were discussing policy decisions and which way they would go and how to couch them in the public eye. And he said, but let's all remember, we're all Eisenhower Republicans here. And that's pretty much the way the landscape has shifted. The Republican Party is far, far to the right than it was in the 60s and 70s. The Democratic Party is far, far to the right than it was in those years. It certainly isn't the same Democratic Party. It's special interest money that has changed it and has changed the landscape. It's the Democratic Party, Inc. and Republican Party, Inc. And we have candidates. Hillary isn't going to change anything. Obama's going to change something, but he won't tell us what. So I think when we have to look at the problem of special interest, we have to look at also solutions that either give us some real change and alternatives and give the spark back to the grassroots.
Well, we also lost a great local community leader this past week, Weston Village President Vilas Mockmuller, who was laid to rest on Tuesday. Here are some comments about Vilas from Marathon County Administrator Mort McBain.
Putting those projects together is always hard, and there are always issues that come up. What people don't see is the work that's gone on behind the lines and the leadership that's there. You know, the proof is in the pudding, sort of, with West, and you can see good things that have happened out there, which tells you that there's some leadership behind the scenes that's getting things done. Vilas is what I would call a classic politician. He was very passionately supporting his community, and I think that passion is what drove him for the years. That was his life.
Pete, you knew Vilas for 14 years.
Yeah, and I understand what Mort's talking about. What I'm going to miss is the twinkle in Vilas' eye when he told you a wisecrack or something like that. He personified Weston, I think, and he was the youngest 79-year-old man I've ever met.
And that was said over and over again at his funeral. And the things I remember in the brief time that I worked for the Village of Weston was his outreach to the Hmong community, his championing of environmental issues, and coming down on the progressive side of some things that you wouldn't expect from a guy who looked like an old grizzled veteran of Wisconsin politics.
Yeah, he kept going and embracing new ideas when I think a lot of his contemporaries couldn't or wouldn't, and they fell out of politics while Vilas kept going for the better part of half a century.
You're listening to a Reporters Roundtable on Route 51 Regional on the Ideas Network.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
You get enough jargon and double talk in the rest of your life. Why would you want it with your science news? I'm Ira Flatow. Each week on Science Friday, we skip the bogus and buzzwords and don't dumb down the big issues in science, medicine, technology, and the environment. So join me on Science Friday as we discuss science sensibly. That's on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
You're listening to a Reporters Roundtable on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. I'm Glenn Moberg, joined by Pete Wasson of the Wausau Daily Herald, Richard Moore of the Lakeland Times, and also Michael Lauber of News Channel 7. Let's move to an environmental issue that's, it used to be a Northwoods issue, but increasingly it's something that we're concerned about throughout north central Wisconsin, and that is the growing population of wolves. Here's a story that we covered at a DNR hearing this past spring.
It's been almost a week since Scott Danicky was walking his dogs in the Lincoln County Forest near Otter Lake, and he's still shaken up.
I had four dogs with me, four German Shorthairs, and I'm walking back to the vehicle. I hear the most ungodly howl I've ever heard. I turn around and look. Well, the howl is coming from my dog, and two wolves got it by the rear end. So I charge at the wolves, yelling. And I get about 20 yards from them before they get off of my dog.
The attack killed Danicky's dog, which may have been in the wrong place at the wrong time. Adrian Whiteven is in charge of the DNR's wolf management program.
I suspect he perhaps walked his dogs too close to a wolf den, and it would have been at a time the pups would have just probably been born within the last week or so, maybe within days.
The attack is generating local concern because it occurred near a swimming lake and campground that are popular summer destinations. But Whiteven notes that the area is surrounded by undeveloped woodlands.
It's a fairly wild country, the sort of place that wolves would inhabit.
And as somebody who swims and fishes at Otter Lake every summer, it got my attention. Richard, do you think there's going to be a lot of support for a wolf hunt at the Conservation Congress meetings?
No comment. No, I'm kidding. It's a hot-button issue, obviously. I don't know how much support there is. I certainly think a wolf hunt is premature. I think calmer heads need to prevail on this issue. So far, we have anecdote and we have sensation, and what we need is some good, hard research. I know the DNR numbers on wolf counts and movements have been challenged. I don't know whether those numbers and counts are correct. I do know the DNR science has been good on some things and awful on others, so that needs to be looked at. There was a report up in Anchorage, Alaska, over the Christmas holidays of three women jogging with their dogs surrounded by a wolf pack of seven or eight wolves. They were aggressive. They had to get them back with pepper spray. We need to look at all these attacks on dogs and livestock and brushes with people and compile it and see just exactly what the issue is. But I do think it's premature to go out and slaughter wolves before we know the facts.
And we have a number of environmental issues that are going to continue to be on the table, and I don't have time to play some of the clips that I set aside for today, but one of them is ATVs on state forest land in Vilas County. That continues to be a hot-button issue with ATV owners saying, hey, this is public land, and the people who live up north saying, we don't want you in our neck of the woods.
Well, I think the state forest issue, I think there's inevitably going to be a trail system there. You're right, there's overwhelming public opposition, as I see it, to ATVs, but then there are business people and there are politicians who see the economies involved here. The interesting thing I'm seeing right now is that this ATV battle is moving, staying not just in the state forest, but moving to townships. Now we have ATV groups going to the town boards and saying, we want you to open the town roads to ATVs so we can get to the trails. We just had that issue in Minocqua. They turned it down, but then they did come up with a compromise and say, okay, we'll allow limited winter use of ATVs on town roads. So this is an issue that's going to go right down to the town board level and across the Northwoods.
And a lot of this is tied into climate change. We're not getting the snowfall that we used to get in the winter. More and more people are buying ATVs instead of snowmobiles, and there's more pressure now for all of them to find a place to put their vehicles. Environmental issues, whether you want to call it climate change or you just say we've had a bad string of winters and summers, we've got drought conditions that are affecting a lot of areas. The Little Plover River, a Class A trout stream, drying up for two consecutive summers in Portage County. Pete Wasson, environmental issues are going to be on the front page pretty frequently, whether we like it or not.
You'd like to think so, but environmental issues have never really gotten the traction with the public that the sexier topics of the day have. I think that there is going to be some focus on environmental issues, particularly energy issues, as the presidential campaigns come to Wisconsin. But I'm not sure that they're going to get the kind of attention that other things are.
And do you think it's possible that our Wisconsin primary this February will actually be significant for at least one side or the other in the presidential races?
Right now, I think it's going to be very significant. I don't think anybody is going to come out of Super Tuesday, or what do we call it now, Super Duper Tuesday?
Tsunami Tuesday is what I've heard.
I don't think anybody's going to come out of that with a clear majority, and one of the next big states on the agenda is Wisconsin. I think, whether you like it or not, you're going to get deluged with campaign ads and probably visits from all of the, at least the two front runners in each party.
Michael, your thoughts on the presidential race as it's, you know, as a young adult, as it's coming down the pike.
Well, it's definitely been interesting to watch. And in Wisconsin, you know, you hope that people who maybe haven't been used to the primaries mattering can get excited to get out there and vote in the primary if it is going to have an impact. I just know for a TV station, obviously, election's a good year. You got those ads that can get annoying, but.
And Richard, we're going to give you the last word on this. We are down to our last minute.
It's going to be a very significant Wisconsin primary. I think Hillary and Obama are going to trade punches and kind of be even all the way into Wisconsin. Edwards gets enough votes to keep anyone from getting a majority, so it's going to be very important and very important for people to vote. The Republican Party is wide open, so I think it'll be significant on that score as well.
All right. Thank you so much. We do want to thank today's guests, Pete Wasson, opinion page editor of the Wausau Daily Herald, Michael Lauber, anchor reporter for WSAW-TV News Channel 7, and by telephone, Richard Moore, investigative reporter for the Lakeland Times in Minocqua. Richard, it's our first time talking to you. Do come back, please.
I certainly will. I enjoyed it much.
You too, Michael. You too, Pete. And thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer. A special thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks again for riding with us today. Until next week, we're heading out of town.